Well, thank you. Thank the organizers for inviting me to the marvelous conference. All the talks here, pretty much all the talks, are concerned with all these things I've listed in the first page here. I mean, of course, the title of the conference is Topological Quantum Computation. One of the key things that you that you rely on to do topological quantum computation, in your head, is the entanglement entropy systems. Quantum Hall effect is a place where we may see this experimentally, a way we understand formally what's going on, or the conformal field theories. The reason all this works out is the quasi-particles have non-abelian statistics. And I think this is just one of the most fantastic fields I've ever worked on, because all this stuff just fits together beautifully. And so I'll tell you about one little bit in this story, which was done by myself, along with Matthew Fisher and Chetan Nayak, the absent organizer. And so I'll tell you today what entropy, how to deal with entropy on the edge of certain interesting systems that you know what they are, and I'll tell you. And then what happens when you put a point contact in, and that's something it's a lot trickier than you might think. And so I'll tell you how that goes. And in particular, I'll show you how to define the tunneling operator. It's not even obvious when you write down the system what operator in the field theory you have describing these things. What operator, tunnels a quasiparticle. And I'll explain how this results in disentanglement. So let me just give the setting. There's almost every talk at this conference is going to have to do with this. So I'm just going to blitz through this. But please ask if I say something too quickly or if I say something wrong. So we're just going to look at particular quantum two-dimensional systems that have gapless chiral edge modes. And we're going to focus basically almost entirely on the edge modes. I'll say some things about the effect of the bulk, which is kind of interesting, at the end. But for the most part, we're going to focus on these edge modes. Like I said, they're gapless, and they all go in one direction. So that's my not very fancy picture of that. And so just to give two examples that you're going to hear a lot about, there's P plus IP superconductor that Nick mentioned, and then Mike Stone's going to talk about this afternoon. There's the Moore Reed state that Nick also discussed in depth this morning. And just to remind you, what happens for the abelian quantum Hall states is you have free chiral bosons living on the edge, and that's what describes the effective field theory of edge modes. But for the non-abelian states we want to do topological quantum computation, we need more complicated theories. And, I'll tell you about those. So for the P plus IP superconductor, which is the example I'm going to spend most of my time talking about today, the edge theory, the theory that describes these things living in this now effectively 1+1-dimensional system, is the chiral icing field theory. And people often say it's the icing model, which is a lattice model of spins. But really, to be precise, it's the field theory that's going on here. There's no lattice, there's no spins. But the formal properties of this particular icing field theory are the same as what you get at the critical point of this two-dimensional classical lattice model. But the word chiral changes a lot, and that's what makes this problem so, interesting, and what makes it technically formidable, and why this conference exists, because a lot of people have to work out what's going on. And so, I'll talk about in detail what that icing field theory is. For the Moore-Reed quantum state, you take that same chiral icing field theory and you add a free boson. And for the stuff we're doing, that's doesn't complicate it that much. The hard part for what we're doing is all in the icing model. And just to defend this, the icing model, people often dismiss, it's just free fermions. Emphasis on the word just, And they say, look, you look up, now it's really easy to find it's diagonalize the Hamiltonian, you just go to the fermionic basis. But the point is, when you diagonalize it by mapping it onto free fermions, which is certainly true, the spin field is non-local in terms of the fermions. So you've mapped it to a new set of variables where everything is free. On the other hand, the variables you're actually interested in the lattice icing model as well as in our icing field theory, are extremely non-trivial. They're non-local. And you can look at McCoy and Wu's book to see an entire book full of ways to actually compute correlations of spin fields. And so it's not a free model. It's a very complicated model, and it has all the physics that we're looking for when we look for topological quantum computers. So anyway, the excitations of this model, so these are the things now living on the edge. So I'm back to this chiral field theory that's describing the edge modes of a P plus IP superconductor. And the edge modes, there's three kinds. And basically, we'll label them with three things. So I is for the identity, but it turns out it's when you write I, you actually mean a whole sector of states. And for example, in the Moore Reed state, the electron itself, so an electron running around the edge, is in the identity sector. And then there's this neutral fermion living on the edge. But the really interesting one, and the one that has the non-abelian statistics, is our friend sigma. So that's the one we're going to talk about. So just to give you a few conventions, I use lots of different words to mean exactly the same thing. So in this talk, edge excitation means excitation, which means quasi-particle. And most of the time, and I'll talk about the sigma quasi-particle. So when I say quasi-particle, I mean sigma quasi-particle. Sometimes I'll call it a particle. Sometimes it's really a hole, and sometimes it's really a quasi-hole. For this talk, they're all the same thing. Just quasi. Okay, so that's number one convention, which I hope other speakers adopt. But anyway, the other one, which since I got to give an early talk, and this formula already appeared in the first talk, and I'm now enshrining the canonical form. I should write it on the board in non-erase pen so that everyone does this convention. I talked to the organizers. You won't get reimbursed unless you use this convention. You have... So this is what's called a fusion product of these fields. And let me explain what that means. So in field theory, what is going on when you write something like this down is that when you take an operator product expansion, so you put two fields close to each other, and then you write them in terms of other fields, effective fields, a famous old work of, I guess, Kadanoff's and Wilson's, people from long ago. So you can do this generically in field theories. And what this particular thing means, so what that means is if I take two of these sigma fields, or these quasi-particles, if you're thinking in terms of edge modes, and you put them together, you put them close together, well, effectively what you can do looks like the identity field plus the psi field. So that's what it means in field theory. Now, in conformal field theory, there's a whole elaborate formalism to deal with these fields. In the special case where the model is gapless and has conformal symmetry, and there's a little fancier way of describing this. It basically means the same thing as the operator product, but you define these integers, which are called fusion coefficients. And basically, what this says is, well, when I fuse a sigma with a sigma, I get the identity, and I just get one copy of the identity, so that number is 1, and I get psi as well, so I get the number 1 there. And so for this talk, and what this has to do with quantum computation, is that there's two possible quantum states for the sigma quasi-particles, which we label by 1 and psi. So there's a whole long story on how this has to do with that, and I'll tell you some about that story today, but this is what really the key thing to keep in mind is. It says that two sigma quasi-particles form a two-state quantum system. Okay, and they're entangled because they can be in 1, they can be in psi, or they can be in any linear combination of those two states. And that's what that formula means. And it's probably for most of the talks in this conference, that's what's of interest. So just to write out the full fusion algebra for the icing model, so the only time you get more than one thing on the right-handed side is for sigma. Sigma, these are familiar if you know something about the icing model, but just note the key thing we'll need in a second is that when you take sigma with psi or psi with psi, there's only one thing on the right-hand side. And of course, when you do, I didn't write down the ones involving the identity just gives you back the field you had. Okay. All right, so now let's count the number of states we have when we've got 2n quasi-particles. So we put them in a row, but the row is just an abstraction. They're anywhere in the sample. And what that fusion relation is, the sigma sigma equals 1 plus psi, says that, well, if I take these two, it doesn't matter which two I pick. They can be anywhere in your sample moving around. And I can have those in this two-state system labeled by 1 and psi, whose basis is 1 and psi. And I just pair them up any way I want. And then my dimension of my entire Hilbert space then is 2 to the n if I have 2n quasi-particles. So you can ask then what the entropy of the system is. And so you just take the log of the number of states, so log of 2 to the n, divide by the number of quasi-particles, and you get the square root of 2, right? Because that's n, and it gives you an n log 2 over 2n. And we have a fancy name for this. We say the sigma quasi-particle has quantum dimension square root of 2. And already that's a little bit weird, because usually when we think of quasi-particles, well, they have this quantum dimension is an integer number. I mean, maybe you've got a spin doublet or something, but you know, if you had two spins, you would have four possible states, right? You'd have just 2 to the n. It's this quantum dimension would be an integer. And what's funny about many of these systems that have non-abelian statistics is these numbers aren't integers. Now, for the other two fields, because there's only one thing on the right-hand side when you fuse those together, their quantum dimensions are just 1. But to get non-abelian statistics, this number doesn't have to be non-integer, but it has to be greater than 1. And because then when you do the braiding, when you do your statistics, what the states that change around, well, are within this Hilbert space here. So D has to be greater than 1. All right, so now, well, I'm going to get to the point contact. So Matthew and I, way back in the golden days of the 1990s, when Chaitan was knee-high to a grasshopper, right? We spent a lot of time understanding what happens when you put point contacts in abelian quantum Hall states. And I didn't think of this before I came out here, but I should have scanned in one of my old transparencies. But I'm sure both Matthew and I drew this same picture 4 billion times over a course of like five years or so. This was going on. And so this is what this picture means. So we've got our thing I drew before, but now we'll put in a point contact. So to a theorist, what a point contact is basically a pinch in the system. So we've got this edge here, and we got this edge here, and we pinch them together. And because we pinch, these are quantum mechanics. Remember, this in here is the bulk quantum Hall system. And these are the excitations living on the edge. And when you pinch the system together, well, at the location of the point contact, they can tunnel across. And the way we did it way back when, well, the way we did then wrote down a field theory to describe this, so he said, well, this edge is really basically independent of that edge. So if we were honest, maybe we drew a reservoir here or something like that. Often this problem gets mapped onto an impurity in a Luttinger liquid, so there, this reservoir at the end really is a physical thing. We ignore what was going on down here and said, look, who cares what's going on down there? Let's just worry about there. And so we said, well, these particles we'll call left movers. Those particles we'll call right movers. And then at the point contact, what can happen is a left mover can tunnel across to a right mover, or a right mover can tunnel across to a left mover. Well, essentially, we could treat those as two independent systems. And then actually, we squashed them together and said, well, we have a left moving system, a right moving system. Now we've got a non-chiral system. And we dealt with that system. So a tunneling event, like I say, annihilates a left mover on one edge and creates a right mover on another, or vice versa. But 90s were an easy decade, and now we have to work harder. In these non-abelian states, I have to worry about the ends, okay? Because I drew this picture. At the beginning, it was the circle with the arrows going around it, so I squashed it a little. The squashing doesn't really matter. But what does matter is the fact that these things up here really are the same edge modes for the same Hall droplet as the ones down here. So in the previous one, it was multicolored because we really thought of those as independent. But here, it's all one color blue. They're all the same edge modes. And why this is important in a non-abelian state is exactly this relation that I wrote down and belabored. sigma sigma equals 1 plus psi. Two sigma quasiparticles can be entangled no matter how far apart they are. So it's perfectly fine for this one to be entangled with one over there, with one over here, with all that. They can all be entangled. So you can't neglect that when you're trying to understand what's going on here. So even though the point contact, this pinch, this gate that the experimentalists put in, is localized, if you're trying to write down the operators in a field theory that tunnel you from there to there, you have to worry about these correlations. Okay? And so another way of saying it is the left and right movers are the indistinguishable particles. So you have to worry about that. They're not independent systems. Okay, so let me just call T the operator which tunnels the quasiparticle from one edge to the other. So to say what we did in the good old days in the abelian case, well, we just said, I know sigma is Hermitian, but in some generic tunneling operator, you'd say annihilate a right mover, create a left mover, or vice versa, and then we treat them as separate fields and put it all together. But in our new non-abelian world, not that new, but our brave non-abelian world, the technical complication is, well, if you define a tunneling operator, I mean, what that really means is you want to define all its correlation functions in some way. But if you just write things like this, this thing doesn't really make any sense. Because you need more information than just the locations of these things. So you might want to consider some TTTs, the correlation between tunneling events at different times. And if I just sort of write it in that form, well, it's not, it's one of the not even wrong things. It's just sort of meaningless until you specify much more information. So the information is in the pictures that Nick was drawing an hour ago. You have to specify these fusion channels. So in other words, because sigma sigma coming together can give you either one or psi, you have to say which one does it. And in fact, instead of writing correlation functions like this, the usual physics notation, you have to define what are called conformal blocks, which are really the chiral parts of correlation functions. Emphasis, we were doing the chiral theory here, not the full Ising model. And so a correlation function, well, you kind of have to start out with something trivial, so the identity. And then you put a bunch of operators here. And so this is sigma, that's sigma at location 1, sigma at location 2. But then we have another variable there, which I've labeled by the AI, which tell you whether that's 1 or psi, which channel they're in, or how they're entangled, lots of ways of saying it, which element of this two-state system, Hilbert space, they take values in. So then, once you specify that, this is a uniquely defined object once you specify all the A's. On the other hand, it's instead of being just one object, this thing we call the correlation function, we've got a space of objects, a 2 to the n dimensional space, a set of objects that are called conformal blocks. Okay, so now, the first problem that we didn't have back in the old days is we have to figure out, what are the AI for this tunneling? So we have a physical situation. We've got a Hall droplet or a P plus IP superconductor. We pinch it, so there's tunneling. That's all very physical. But what's the operator that tunnels a quasiparticle from one edge to the other? Let's think about it. So the simplest kind of, you can imagine, anything can happen. I mean, in an experiment, they can do lots of things in the lab. But let's try and think of what the simplest thing to do is. And the simplest thing to do is, it just really takes the quasiparticle on the one edge and then lets it jump across the sample to the other edge, but doesn't change any of the entanglement, doesn't do any of this stuff. So if it, if it was entangled with somebody across the sample before, if it jumps across, it's still entangled. You don't mess that anything up. And technically, what that means in those terms of these pictures is, so say I've got some quantum state A here, and then this is my tunneling operator. So this, say, corresponds to annihilating a quasiparticle on one edge and then creating it on the other. Well, if this were some quantum state, A, which is 1 or psi, after you do this, it's still A. So that's the precise way to define this tunneling operator. And that's now unambiguous. Okay. So you can write down all those pictures. In principle, you could use all this very fancy technology to compute those correlators, but it's pretty ugly and you don't really gain any intuition into the problem. So to use that, to get further, to understand what this tunneling operator really means, we want to rewrite it. And the way you do it is these braiding and fusing rules that, again, were mentioned earlier today, that were developed by Moore Seiberg. So Moore Seiberg wrote these classic papers in conformal field theory in the late 80s that were sort of essentially killed the field. I mean, in the late 80s, string theorists were really interested in conformal field theory because, I don't know, God gave you the world sheet or something. So it was, you went to any talk in that generation, you were informed that understanding conformal field theory was the key to understanding the key to the universe. But by the late 80s, that was clear that that wasn't true. And then Moore and Seiberg came along with these beautiful papers where formally they really understood what was going on in conformal field. It wasn't so easy to understand in 10 minutes so that you could write a paper with an introduction saying you were solving the riddles of the universe. So people moved on to other stuff, leaving the field wide open for condensed matter theorists like us. So so there's this marvelous body of work in the late 80s that I think only now is now really being dragged into condensed matter physics. And so what it does, and you can make me in the question period, so I didn't, you know, it's a fairly long story, but you can make me go to the board in the question period and I can show you more of how this works. But you take those operators, those pictures I drew, and you apply these rules developed by Moore and Seiberg, and you can work this around on. So if you want to hear more details, ask me and I'll tell you how that goes. But I'll give you the quick summary. Is basically, formally, you can fold the system in half. So you can treat the point contact as basically a boundary now. So you fold it in half. And it turns out that you take two icing models together. So now we have two icing models, the one from the left half and the one from the right half. And you can turn that into a free boson. For people who know conformal field theory, know you can bosonize two icing models. This was done ages ago, back in the old conformal field theory days, but this is trickier because this is chiral again. So it takes a little work. You have to deal with all the Moore Seiberg stuff. But it's very closely related to a problem that Oshikawa and Affleck studied in great depth, which is the icing model with the defect line. So the point contact plays the role of the defect. So when you go through this, and like I say, make me give you more details if you want. You get the Kondo problem, which in some ways isn't shocking, and if I tell you some more details, maybe that'll become more transparent. But for those of you who don't know what the Kondo problem is, I'll tell you a little bit about it. So this is written in terms of this chiral boson. The people who know the Kondo problem know it can be bosonized. But what it really is you have a quantum spin, so just some atom, it's got a spin. So it couples to a bunch of electrons which also have spin. And you ignore everything but their antiferromagnetic spin coupling. So you've got an isolated impurity with a sea of electrons around it. That's the Kondo problem. And so what we've said, we replace our point contact plays the role of this isolated impurity, and the other quasi-particles living on the edge play the role of the sea of electrons around it. So schematically, it's the same. What's the remarkable thing? It's a special case, a particular anisotropic limit, the standard case of the Kondo problem. So, okay, so I claim we did this to learn about some physics, so let me tell you about the physics that mapping it onto the Kondo problem gives you. So, remember I talked about entropy. That's the interesting thing, the topological quantum computation. And so let's talk about it in the Kondo language. We've got an isolated spin here. It can flip back and forth. It's talking. It sees all these impurities. So the ultraviolet limit of the problem in our problem is no point contact. You don't pinch the sample together. The two edges, you know, just go. Everything just goes around the whole disk. Okay. So that's the ultraviolet limit. In the Kondo problem, that just means this isolated impurity isn't coupled to all those electrons. Okay. So that's fine. But now we add in this tunneling, and it turns out, if you work out, it's a relevant perturbation. So we change the physics dramatically just by allowing a little tunneling. That was the brilliant revelation, basically, of Kondo 40 years ago. We realized in modern language it's a relevant perturbation. And so you change the physics at the point contact quite dramatically by allowing tunneling. And so what happens in the Kondo problem is Well, it interacts antiferromagnetically, and it gets screened. So it's not that hard to understand. As you allow this spin that's flipping back and forth, well, what happens is if the interaction gets stronger and stronger, that's what it means to have a relevant operator. Well, eventually some electron from the bolt comes, gloms on to the impurity, and makes it form a spin singlet. And what we say is that's screened. So therefore, the spin is basically no longer there. We've taken a spin a half, happily flipping away, an electron gloms onto it, and now it's spin zero. And where this has to do with entropy, well, in the ultraviolet limit, the spin was happily flipping away, so it had two quantum states. The entropy of that bit was log 2. In the ultraviolet, it screened away, it's log 0. So no entropy there. Oops. As Eduardo knows, in fact, I was preparing these at 9 o'clock this morning. So, yeah, that would be interesting, though. Someone should think about log 1, excuse me, which has an entropy of 0. Yeah, so the first wrong equation, and it's probably not the last. So this is why I tend not to write equations in my talks, because this is what happens. Okay, so. So, yeah. Yeah, sure. I gave you the best I could, so I have to. I can get. That's the best I could do. I ask again the question period. I can babble some more, but I don't. What I said, it's put it this way. It's one of these rare cases in my career, and probably in anybody's career, where we did a computation and weren't expecting that as an answer. So we didn't know we were going to get that. We just had to do the computation, and that was after several months of being very confused. That's the answer we got. Okay, so let's understand what that entropy loss is. Okay, so first let's think of what's going on here. All right, so in the absence of the point contact, we have that stupid picture of a disk I drew with edge modes. I think the arrows got longer here, but that doesn't mean anything. But what does mean something is we pinch this disk in the middle by putting this point contact, so stuff can tunnel from there to there. And because this is relevant, the thing you would expect physically happen, well, in the infrared limit, the long distance limit, or the low temperature limit, what happens is, well, everything will tunnel. So if you pinch this completely, well, it splits in two. Everything on this half splits to there, and everything on the other half jumps to there. So we've split, the point contact splits the system in two in the infrared limit. And so the entropy lost is entanglement entropy, right? Because now there's two separate systems. So again, my clever color coding scheme. This is a completely independent system of that. So we split the system in two. So this will have some internal entropy. This will have some entropy. But what it won't have is entanglement entropy between the stuff in here, and we don't have quasi-particles in the bulk. There's stuff on the edge, obviously, and the stuff over there. So sticking in this point contact has disentangled the systems. So let me explain that in a little more technical detail. So there's some beautiful papers that were written just within the last year by Kataev and Preskill and Levin and Wen. And what they showed in a topological field theory in general, and it certainly applies to the particular theories that we're studying here, is there's a number which they call D, and it's the total topological angle entropy of a disk is minus log D. And D is basically given by this square root of the squared sum of D squared, where D are those quantum dimensions I defined. So this telling you the dimension of this Hilbert space. And, I'm sure Mike Levin will talk about, I'm sure this will be talked about later in the conference, so I'll defer any questions about the profound meaning of this formula, because I think this is a profound formula. And I'll let those authors answer their deep questions. But I'll work out an example, which is the one we've been doing. So we've got this identity sector, the one where the electron is in Moore Reed. We've got this edge fermion. And then we've got the interesting sigma quasi-particle. And so to use this formula, we've got, 1 squared plus 1 squared plus square root of 2 squared equals square root of 2. That one looks right. So all right, I got one. Got one number right here. So. And so what Kataev and Preskill and Levin and Wen tell you is that the entropy of that disk is minus log 2. right, well, so that's the ultraviolet entropy. We've got a disk minus log 2. In the infrared, to show my stunning pictures here, well, up here the entropy is minus log 2. That's what the formulas of all these guys said. Well, but then in the infrared, once the point contact is taken over and split the system in two, well, we've got two disks. So the entropy goes down, right? We've lost this entanglement, and sure enough, you use their formula, and, well, there's two disks, so you're just going to minus 2 log 2. And so the difference is the minus log 2. So to go back to the Kondo language for a second, this screening of this spin, which in our case is a mathematical artifact, not a physical, there's not a physical spin there, but it represents the entropy that entangles the two halves of the system. That I'm entangled with the. Stop. Anyway, so, and again to say what I've said before, in the UV, a quasiparticle on the left half can be entangled with the one on the right half. In the infrared, it can't, so therefore you lose entropy. And that's the formula, and that's the log 2 that, well, I had the right answer, but if I'd put log 1, like I should have. And so to emphasize again, the main point of this talk is that a point contact causes this entanglement. Let me say a little bit more in depth. So I worried, when I made these transparencies, I worried there were just too few formulas, so I had to put a few in. So let me, since there's a lot of conformal field theory at this conference, I thought I'd say a little bit more, because this is, well, it's a little bit technical, but it's kind of nice, and that's the end of the talk, so. Yeah, sure. Yeah, but then you would have tunneling, you know, from any point to any point. So.
That's the point. So you can probably not always take what I'm saying. You don't think that's one point.
Yeah, but
these arguments you're giving is that general that you make it sound. But in practice.
Yeah. Well, in practice, then you would never have a disk because it would always.
You'd be. You always have tunneling. It's unit power minus 5,000. That is it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I said the infrared limit. So yes, you would have to go to e to the minus 5,000 temperature to see that. No, because the temperature scale, I mean, it's a Go Kondo, you know, as you know, in the Kondo problem, there's a Kondo temperature. So the Kondo temperature associated with the point contact is far larger than the Kondo temperature associated with random tunneling from one point to another. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, but you have one experimental parameter, which is the gate voltage, right? So what you do is you start your experiment without that open. You say, well, okay, my things are not tunneling across the sample, or I'm at a temperature large enough. And so go from there. Oops. Okay, so let me just tell you a little bit about boundary conformal field theory. So now there's a third S. So even though I have no formulas, I've used S three separate ways in this talk now. So there's the Kondo spin S, there's, of course, the entropy S, and there's a very important object in conformal field theory called the modular S matrix, not to be confused with the scattering S matrix, which I spent most of my career studying. So modular S matrix basically describes the behavior of conformal field theories when you interchange space and time. And they have all these remarkable properties, many of which were understood in great depth by John Cardy in the 1980s. And one can use this conformal field theory to show that this number d, minus log d is the entanglement entropy, is related to the sort of simplest element in the in this modular S matrix. And why that's useful is because there's an amazing formula that Eric Verlinde, which takes this modular S matrix and relates it to these ends. So the ends are the things we've been talking about. They're the fusion coefficients. So they're the things that when you put two sigmas together, the fact that we get an I and the fact that we get a psi is encoded by there. But this matrix here, which you can compute using conformal field theory techniques, then spits out what the what these fusion coefficients are. And so now then, the Verlinde formula, I had to put this in because it's so cute. The Verlinde formula actually then gives you what the quantum dimensions are, basically almost instantly. So think of define this matrix Q, which is just, there's three indices here. So there's a bunch of matrices QA whose elements are given by NABC, so that QA is a matrix. And if you think about it for a second, what QA does is tell you if I've got some particle, some quasi-particle A, and I fuse it with a quasi-particle C, well, it tells you whether you're going to get a B or not. So that's it's a matrix. And then you think about it a little more, and I can show this on the blackboard again if this is too vague. It's just the quantum dimensions are just the eigenvalues of, well, the largest eigenvalue of Q. Okay. And so, but then using this Verlinde formula, just right there, you plug into that formula I wrote down in last transparency, you muck, just literally use that formula, and you see that these things are the eigenvectors, and then these are the eigenvalues. So, and when you work out the largest eigenvalue, it's of that form. So it's a miraculous formula that gives the quantum dimension in terms of this object that for any conformal field theory is a straightforward computation to get. Well, and so to go back to physics, there's an interesting interpretation of this, of this whole picture on the last transparency and the Verlinde formula in terms of 1 plus 1D boundaries. So in our 2 plus 1D system, remember we've got a boundary. Okay, so we have the disk. And so we have this effect of 1 plus 1D systems. That's but already our 1D system is a boundary. Okay. But then we put this point contact in. Well, if you think now, say let's squash the disk down to a line segment, then this point contact becomes a boundary. So it really is like the boundary of a boundary. And all of these things we can do can be interpreted as a boundary entropy. This is the interpretation of Affleck and Ludwig. And then, again, run through all the same arguments and get the results I've talked about. And one can then do more than this, because there's more sources of entropy in the problem. You can include bulk sigma quasi-particles. Haven't said much about this. I'm sure people will be saying more about this during the conference. But those are the qubits in the quantum computer. You have these sigma quasi-particles in the bulk. Again, they obey the magic relation, sigma equals 1 plus psi, and that's how you make your qubits. And then you can extend all this formalism to understand entropy in more complicated situations. So let me just, yeah, good. So a few minutes, and then I'll just tell you how this goes for more Reed state, so the Hall effect. You basically do everything we just did, but you add in an extra chiral boson on the edge. So that's the result Nick talked about this morning. And what you get now are six kinds of quasi-particles. So we had three for the Ising model, I, sigma, and psi, but now you have to add on bosons. Oops, I forgot an I there. And there's an I, the square root of minus one, there and there. And so these are the interesting ones. These things have charge one and quarter. Those would be the things that you would make your qubits of. And these in the conformal field theory language, as Nick mentioned this morning, are the primary fields in a superconformal field theory. So the quantum dimensions of those six fields, the two interesting ones are the charge plus quarter and charge minus a quarter. Those are the ones that have the square root of 2. The square root of 2 just comes straight from the Ising model. The reason is adding a boson, everything in a free boson theory has quantum dimension 1, so that's not going to not going to change a whole lot. And it just basically makes more particles. We now have two of these square root of 2 and then the other four. You're there. You plug into that formula we just gave and you get 2 square root of 2. And so, since I timed this right, I know I wouldn't have time to tell you in detail, but so now basically you couple that other boson in, and so you can define the tunneling operator in the Moore-Reed theory. What it looks like is very closely related, that's different from a two-channel Kondo problem. Basically adding the boson is equivalent to adding the second channel for the Kondo problem. It's not exact. It differs from the two-channel Kondo problem in a crucial way, but it's basically the same thing. And so again, you can do the computation in that language, and again, I can show you on the board afterwards if anyone wants to see it, and of course get this 2 square root of 2. And then this formalism is very powerful. Nick mentioned there's lots of more Reed states. It's the parameter he called M. And if you do this computation for the bosonic Moore-Reed state that has an SU2 symmetry, you get 2. Okay, so good. To conclude, let me just say some things that haven't been done, at least not by us. The important physical thing, we computed a few exponents for transport quantities, but to actually compute them, in this crossover from no tunneling to all tunneling to pinching them too. So, and back in the old days, people did some computations. The condo model is solvable, and one might hope one can do it. I haven't told you, I ruthlessly suppressed one important detail, which is there's other relevant operators as well, as opposed to the quasi-particle tunneling operator. You can tunnel these psi quasi-particles as well, and that's a marginal perturbation, but that actually affects the physics in an important way, the fact that that happens. So computing in this setup, and then the two-channel setup as well, things like the current and the noise, and then we made this very simple point contact assumption. We said, well, it can't change any kind of entanglement. Well, obviously, point contacts can be far more complicated, and, well, what can you say about that sort of tunneling? Then what's especially interesting, what a lot of people have talked about, and what Carol Stengel will be talking about next, is taking this 5/2 or generalized quantum Hall state and, you know, putting dots and anti-dots and point contacts and leads and all that sort of stuff. And of course, it's the same type of problem here, but much more complicated. And as they've shown, and as you'll hear, there's lots of interesting things can happen. So it would be interesting to understand how to, you know, push that a little further and do what we did for those cases. And then there's these whole hierarchies, you know, these 12/5, and what's the next one? I don't remember, something 7th. The Reed-Rezaei states, and you know, all the conformal field theory stuff for these cases sort of goes through. In fact, most of it's been worked out by Nick Reed and collaborators. All right, but what has not been worked out at all is the analog of the condo problem. It's probably, our guess is, it's some kind of crazy multi-channel condo problem, but we haven't shown that yet. It would be interesting to see that. So anyway, lots of details and our papers to hopefully come soon. Anyway, thanks a lot.
When you say the P plus IP case is like the condo problem, does that mean that the tunneling operator is only marginally relevant?
No, it's a good question. In this, it's actually the anisotropic condo problem. So it's dimension 1/8. Okay. It's changing the radius of the boson in the bosonic language. And the condo problem, it corresponds to breaking the SU2 symmetry by changing the relative coefficient of the JZSE term to the JX. It's just plain old very relevant. It's dimension 1/8. Yeah.
And is there any way to tune back to the isotropic point, or that would have no realization as a tunneling problem?
Yeah, certainly formally it would be exactly the same, and it would be so.
That's what I don't understand. When you say formally, yeah, it'd be exactly the same, but the scaling dimension of the operator that takes you to the critical point is different.
Yeah, in fact, that's part of the crucial difference. When I mentioned in the two-channel case, there's this crucial difference between the condo problem there. So in the single-channel condo problem, the thing that's relevant for people's IP, changing the dimension of that operator, you know, by adding anisotropy really doesn't change the physics that much. You still got a quantum spin, okay? You know, flipping back and forth, two-state system coupled to a bath. You're just changing the coupling to the bath. So still this entropy loss of log 2. Now, in the Moore-Reed case, there's a second boson, and that has a radius as well. Changing that radius changes the quantum dimension. So that's why this SU2 level 2 case I wrote down and the Moore-Reed case, the Moore-Reed electron case, are different. So changing that one matters a lot. Changing the other one doesn't seem to really make a whole lot of difference for this physics thing.
So let me ask you again, where does the condo spin come from? Is it simply related to the fact that you have two fusion channels, or is something more hidden than that?
It's certainly, obviously, it's related to the fact that there are two channels, because for more complicated, whatever the analog of P plus IP is for the Reed-Rezaei states, there's not just two channels, and stuff will be much weirder. Here's what I can say. So when you're looking, so this is how the Moore cyber. So this is the tunneling operator at some time t1. and this is the tunneling operator at some time t2. And so what we said is, well, we've got something coming in there, and the tunneling doesn't change the entanglement. So that will be A, and then that will be A. Okay. So now all this more Seiberg stuff, right, tells you how to move this stuff around. In particular, what you need to do is disentangle these two things. So use the more Seiberg stuff to disentangle these things. Okay, so what happens when you do the more Seiberg stuff? You'll shuffle these things around. You braid them and fuse them and do some stuff. So this will change, and you'll get a sum over a bunch of stuff. But what doesn't change is this and this, right? Because all I'm doing is tangling stuff around in here. And what the key thing about Kondo is what it does. So if Kondo is of this form, S plus of something plus S minus of something. Okay, and with S plus squared equals S minus squared equals zero. So what it says, so we still, no matter what we do in here, no matter, you know, whether it's Kondo or some crazy generalization of Kondo, this to this isn't going to change. Okay? And that's, Kondo basically forces that, because what it says is you don't really have any choice. So expand a bunch of tunneling things around. Well, if I pick S plus, right, so if I have two tunneling operators, so T1, T2, will then be some sort of S plus something plus S minus something, and then S plus something plus S minus something. But because S squares to zero, this basically reduces this entire product, if you have a bunch of them here, to just two terms, right? Because you always have to alternate S plus S minus, S plus S minus. And that's the analog of always going from A to A, because A can be 1 or psi. So if it starts at 1, well, it has to be 1. And that's one of those chains. And then, so that's the best intuition I have as to why it has to be Kondo. In a way, that really is. It can't be anything else. If anything more complicated would change this around, and that was our fundamental assumption, is that that doesn't get changed around.
Well, the fact that it goes from A to A after two steps,
yeah,
that's
well, this particular assumption that
the thing goes along the side,
yeah,
and there's not a sigma on the right.
Right, but it's just our assumption. But it doesn't matter. I mean, if there were 12 things here, the fact that our tunneling operator is the simple form, that it's not changing anything, it still doesn't matter. So yeah, it'll be some more complicated that's why it'll be some multi-channel, so it'll be more than two. It'll be three or something for the next one. But it'll still be Kondo-like in that you have to get from A to A, even if A runs from 1 to 10. Preserve this for posterity.
Is the horizontal line that you drew, is that supposed to be the edge of the quantum Hall puddle, and these are charges on it, or quasi-particles on it?
Yeah, you can think of it. Yeah, you can think of it that way.
Well, that's what I was trying to do.
Yeah, okay.
But why isn't it a circle?
Well, when you compute a correlator, well, it's the edge in the middle. So it's the point. So what we've done, right, we've taken this thing, so we've pinched it down, right? So what this really is mocking the effects of the point content, right? This is the tunneling operator, because they're all localized at the same spatial point. They're different points in time, but they're the same spatial point. So what this really is a string in this direction, the time direction.
Hmm.
Okay? But they're all at the same spatial point. And basically, so one end is spatial minus infinity, and you just say that's in the identity, and then the other end is, temporal. Temporal minus infinity, and the other end is temporal thing. So now we are at finite temperature, or you can do this at finite temperature, and then then it is a circle.
Okay.
Oh yeah, I didn't tell you. So for the Laughlin, that's a good question. So yeah, this is something that I didn't know the answer to until I worked all this stuff out. So for, say, let's just do 1/3 because it's the easiest. What you get is, there's basically three states here. There's basically the identity, and there's charge plus 1/3. I guess that's charge zero, and then charge, think of it as 2/3 or minus 1/3. And the key principle, so I didn't say about this, but when you're thinking about the conformal field theory, there's a very nice physical thing. I should have put this in the talk, so now you can excuse to say it. So when you develop, figure out, there's an important question. What are the basic fields? You know, how did I know to stop here? Why don't I have a -1/3 and a 2/3? Why don't I have a 10/3? All that. How do I know that it's just these three? Well, the way you know is the physical input you do is when you say, if you fuse with an electron, the real physical, honest-to-God electron, then you don't get a new state in this picture. You know, it's in the conformal field theory language, they're called descendant states. So notice, if I patch an electron to this one -1/3, well, I get something of 2/3. And so the rule is, well, that's the same, for this counting, it's the same state. But obviously, an electron's charge 1, I can't get from any of these three to the other. But now, since they're abelian, everything has quantum dimension 1. So then the quantum dimension here is then just square root of 3. Yeah, so you're back in its square root of 3. So in fact, when I was doing this, I was reading some paper and it mentioned this, and so it had a reference to who computed this in 1994, and it was me. So yeah, it's for free boson. It's in the usual Luttinger G that, of course, you know.
You remember that a few months ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, luckily. So it's 1/2. It's log square root of G. It's log square root of G. The Fenley-Soler and Warner formula from 1994. So yeah, we without knowing any of this, we computed the correct answer a long time ago. Oh yeah. So it's this. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's not well worded. So what I mean, so we could easily imagine some kind of geometry. You know, it's still a point contact, but maybe there's a dot inside the point contact. So instead of just hopping, you know, across the sample, it hops onto a dot in the middle, or hops onto edge of an anti-dot, I guess, and then hops across. And so one can easily imagine that this could change state, because if, for example, if you had an anti-dot in the middle, you can have an odd or an even number of quasi-particles living on the dot. So it could change. So what goes through, you can maybe leave a psi quasi-particle behind as you hop across, and so this could change, you know, from A to B and all that, and that would be, well, more complicated, but physically, well, possibly very interesting. And in a way, the next two are kind of the same one. So this one then says, well, allow it to change state, but then, you know, for these more complicated geometries, then you have 2-point contacts and a dot in between, and then that's even making the problem more complicated. Yeah, we couldn't think of any way of, if you just a plain old point contact, no anti-dot, I don't think there's any way of doing other than our assumption. At least we couldn't think of anything that would change the state if you weren't doing anything more, if you didn't have a fancy point contact. Yeah, maybe wrong. Maybe someone can tell us how to do that just with a plain old point contact.
Thanks again.